as we get closer and closer to the end of this course, I thought it was an appropriate time to talk about getting closer and closer. In other words, the subject of asymptotics. So today we'll discuss what I mean by asymptotics, so asymptotic relations, asymptotic series, and one example of how to derive asymptotic series. So why are we studying this subject? We often want to understand the behavior of functions as an argument gets large or small, or near a point where we know how to say something exact about it, but we can't solve the differential equation or evaluate an integral for all values of a parameter. Our usual tool that we use when we can want to solve something near a point where we know how to solve it exactly, convergent series, can be very difficult to find in many cases that we're interested in. So our main reason we want to study asymptotics is that convergent series are often hard to find. It's often much easier or only possible to find an asymptotic series, which doesn't have the same information as a convergent series. But in many cases, it's better. For instance, if you want to approximate a function numerically, you often can do much better using an asymptotic series with a smaller number of terms than you can with a convergent series. And I'll elaborate on those points in a bit and define what I mean precisely by an asymptotic series later. But before I do that, I just want to elaborate on one important example. So in QFT, we'll be interested in path integrals, for instance, for phi-4 theory, which looks something like this in d dimensions. Now, we'll see later in the year what precisely this means. But the important point is that in general, we don't know how to evaluate this path integral exactly for lambda non-zero. It's possible to do if lambda equals zero. But for lambda non-zero, there are no known techniques for evaluating this kind of integral. And in fact, we can't even find a convergent series for this integral. But we can find an asymptotic series. So to see what the reason why it's hard to get an convergent series for an expression like this, let's look at a toy example, a zero-dimensional path integral. And so we can write down a integral that's one we know how to do. With an extra term, it's should resemble this pi to the fourth interaction term. So I'll ignore the fact that we actually can evaluate this in terms of special functions, unlike this case, and just mimic the procedure that we'll do in quantum field theory when we're doing perturbation theory. So in quantum field theory, the only integrals we, for the most part, the only integrals we know how to do are the Gaussian ones, where we only have quadratic terms in the exponent and possibly some polynomials multiplying the exponential. So let's see if we can turn this integral into that form. So what we can do is we can Taylor expand e to the minus lambda x to the fourth. And if we do that, what we get is an integral that almost looks like something we know how to evaluate. Now, since everyone got to question 5a, you all know how to evaluate these integrals as long as we switch the sum and integral. So if we do that, then we just got an integral of x to some power times a Gaussian. And in the tutorial yesterday, you learned how to evaluate those integrals one way. I'll show you another way in a minute. So we can evaluate this as long as we switch the sum and the integral sign. It's not clear that that's a valid operation, but let's go ahead and do it because there's not that much else we can do. Pull out some of the factors in front. Got a minus 1 to the n. Lambda to the n over n factorial, integral e to the minus, minus infinity to the infinity of e to the minus x squared x to the 4n dx. Okay. So we can evaluate this integral either using the technique we learned in the tutorial yesterday or using what we learned in lecture on Tuesday.
Why is it
0D? 0D. So if we look at the analogy with the path integral in quantum field theory that I wrote down on the left, small d, pull this down. So this d defers to the dimension of space-time. So since we don't have any integral in the exponent, this integral is like a toy example of what we have over here if there's no space and no time. Okay. So we can make a change of variables, u equals x squared, and evaluate the right-hand side over there. And we get c of lambda may be equal to the sum n equals 0 to infinity minus 1 to n lambda to the n over n factorial. The integral then just becomes integral from 0 to infinity. E to the minus u, x to the 2n minus 1, u, du, which you should all recognize as a gamma function. So you could also get the same result using the result of the tutorial from yesterday. And this then becomes this should be a half here. Becomes gamma of 2n plus a half. Okay, great. So we've got a result. Does this converge? we've done this questionable operation of switching the summation and integration. And what we end up with is something that has a gamma of 2n plus a half over n factorial in each term. So we note that gamma of 2n plus a half is more or less the same thing as 2n factorial. If n is large, the fractional errors become small. Which is greater than n factorial squared. If n is large. So in our sum, we've got something bigger than n factorial squared over n factorial. So the terms get bigger and bigger. It doesn't converge. Does that mean it's useless? Absolutely not. This technique of switching the sum and integral is one of our main techniques in perturbation theory and QFT. And if this is meaningless, then so is almost all of QFT. So we better be able to understand this result. It does tell us something about the original function. It's not an equality sign. So it's not equal to, but it does give us information about the original expression. And in fact, this is the right-hand side is our first example of an asymptotic expression. So this should really be an asymptotic two. This means asymptotic two. And so this is an asymptotic series. In a minute, I'll explain precisely what I mean by an asymptotic series. But before I do that, I'm going to need to give you two definitions, two intermediate definitions before I can define what I mean by an asymptotic series.
Lambda is a positive number, mm-hmm. then this increases the convergence of the integral, right? Because it's
yes.
decaying faster. So is there any way to see that if lambda is reasonably chosen, that this thing might as well converge? Because this looks like that irrespective of what lambda takes as values, this is always blowing up. Is there any way to see this, that for maybe positive lambda, there is something that we
can yes. So I mentioned that I'm ignoring the fact that there is another way in this case, but not in QFT, that we can evaluate this integral exactly. If I'm remembering correctly, it's related to the Bessel functions. So I can, the integral does converge. This sum does not converge.
The thing is just that if the sum converges, the integral converges, then it should be allowed to split the limits, right?
No.
So this is why I remember somehow.
There are conditions that you can impose that make switching the sum and integral valid, but for interest in time, I'm going to skip a lot of the technical details, just give you sort of the essentials, but I'd be happy to discuss later. Okay. So, need some definitions. Our first definition is we say the function f of x is much less than the function g of x. This is important. So as x approaches x naught, if the limit as x goes to x naught of f of x over g of x is 0. Okay. So two examples. So first one is a simple example. The function x is much less than the function 1 over x as x goes to 0. This one goes to 0. This one blows up, so nothing surprising there. However, we also see that using this definition, the function x squared is much less, which is always positive, is much less than negative 1 as x goes to 0. So this is something that's always positive, is much less than something negative. Still satisfies this definition. So, okay. We mean something technical and different from the ordinary usage of much less in this context. Okay, that's our first definition. We need one more definition before we can see what we mean, see what we actually got over here. Our second definition is the definition of an asymptotic relation. So we say that the function f of x is asymptotic to the function g of x as x goes to x naught. This means asymptotic to. There's a couple of equivalent ways of stating this. So the first one we could say is that if f of x minus g of x is much less than g of x as x goes to x naught, or equivalently, if the limit as x goes to x naught of f of x over g of x equals 1. So these are two equivalent ways of stating what it means for a function f to be asymptotic to a function g as x goes to x naught. So two functions can be asymptotic as x goes to x naught, but not as x goes to x1. So this is an important part of the condition. So again, let's look at a few examples. So a simple one is that cosine of x is asymptotic to minus 1 as x goes to pi. And so the limit of cosine of x is minus 1 as x goes to pi. What about the cosine of x plus 1 as x goes to pi? Might like to think, based on this previous example, that this is asymptotic to 0. But if we look at our definition, this means that this cosine of x minus 1 minus 0 would have to be much less than 0, which doesn't work. So nothing is asymptotic to 0. If we look at our definition of nothing that's non-zero is asymptotic to 0. Another example, x squared and x. As x goes to 0. So these are both approximately equal to 0 as x goes to 0. But they approach 0 at different rates. So this limit is not 1. So these are not, again, not asymptotic to each other. Okay. All right. So, Peter.
So shouldn't you just include like something about this first derivative in your definition of asymptotic?
These are the definitions of asymptotic. If if G is zero and F is not identically zero, there's no way that this limit can be one. So we don't need to place any other additional constraints on our functions. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
So what about like x squared sometimes x is like x close to 1?
Oh yes, so that would work.
Oh, okay.
So a statement about whether a function is asymptotic to another function depends on the point. This statement is meaningless if I don't tell you about which point. Okay. So now we're ready to define asymptotic series. So we say that a function y has an asymptotic series that given by the sum from n equals 0 to infinity of a n x minus x naught to the n as x goes to x naught if y of x minus the partial sum up to n of the same series is much less than x minus x naught to the n as x goes to x naught for all n. So what does this mean? This means that for a fixed number of terms, as you get closer and closer to x naught, the function gets closer and closer to the partial sum. It says nothing whatsoever about whether keeping more terms makes the approximation better. And in general, keeping more terms beyond a certain point will make the approximation worse. Just want to make a few comments about asymptotic series. We're not going to go through general ways of deriving them for lack of time and all of the properties for how to manipulate them. We will go through one, the most important way of deriving asymptotic series. And I'm not going to actually show that it gives us an asymptotic series. It does, in general. I'll come to that after I finish a few comments about asymptotic series in general. The method we'll look at is called the saddle point approximation. And it's used all the time in quantum field theory and elsewhere. OK, so a few comments about asymptotic series. So first one is convergent series are better with more terms. Asymptotic series are better as x goes to x naught with a fixed number of terms. Asymptotic series can be convergent. They don't have to be. So nothing says that, and the first example we came across says that the asymptotic series converges. Nevertheless, they're often better approximations than convergent series if you want to numerically approximate a function. And typically, if the asymptotic series is not convergent, the terms will start growing at some point. So there'll be a smallest term. And usually the best way to approximate a function using its asymptotic series at a point is to truncate the series before the smallest term. Including more terms can make your approximation worse. Getting closer to the point, on the other hand, is the only thing that's guaranteed. The approximation improves as you get closer to the point. That's all that's guaranteed by our definition. Okay. So a few other comments. Asymptotic series are unique and non-unique. And I mean that. So a function has a unique asymptotic series at each point. So f of lambda, say if we want to approximate this at lambda equals 0, has a unique asymptotic series. Lambda goes to 0. So functions have unique asymptotic series. But an asymptotic series does not uniquely determine the function. So to see that, note that f of lambda plus b times e to the minus c over lambda squared has the same asymptotic series. And to see that, note that e to the minus c over lambda squared is much less than lambda to the n for any n, any positive n, as lambda goes to 0. So asymptotic series do not uniquely determine functions. And in physics, this kind of function that doesn't show up in an asymptotic series is known as a non-perturbative function. And in the review and exploration courses, we'll look at, in several of them, we'll examine how we can find effects that are missed by the perturbation series. For instance, if we're interested in tunneling or the decay of the false vacuum, these are things you never will see in a perturbation series, which is what will the techniques that we'll be learning about in the first semester in QFT will basically be how to do perturbative QFT. Also, for instance, U1 axial current non-conservation in QCD is something that depends on non-perturbative physics. That'll be a topic for the second semester. So if we have a convergent series and it converges in a finite radius, then it's unique. So if we have a convergent series, it has a unique limit. So this if we add something to a function, that will change the series if it's convergent. It doesn't necessarily change the series if the series is an asymptotic series. Does that answer your question? A final comment before we start learning how to compute asymptotic series is that if we have an asymptotic relation in the complex plane. It's generally only valid in some wedge. So that means for some range of the argument of z minus z naught. So asymptotic relations in the complex plane are only valid if you approach the limit point from certain directions. And you can sort of see that from here. So if we approached lambda equals 0 from the imaginary axis, then this term would no longer be small. So and this is known as Stokes phenomena. So the most useful, but not the only useful method of finding asymptotic series assumes that the function you want to find an asymptotic series for is given by an integral. And we'll go through one example, and then I'll present the general method. So the example I want to go through is Stirling's approximation. So this is approximation for n factorial, or gamma of n plus 1 for n large. So we all know that gamma of x plus 1 is given by the integral from 0 to infinity of t to the x e to the minus x dt. And the basis behind our approximation is going to be the following observation. So we notice that the integrand is only large in a small region. So for x large enough, this should be a t. For t large enough, e to the minus t becomes tiny, and the integrand becomes tiny. If t is small and x is large, then for small t, also the integrand becomes tiny very quickly. So there's only some intermediate region where we get a meaningful contribution to the integrand. And because the only integrals we really know how to do in general are integrals with Gaussian weight, our basic approximation is we're going to massage the integrand until we can force it to look something like a Gaussian times a power series, and do the same kind of thing we did in our first example. So to do that, we can make the following change of variables. Let t equal wx, and gamma of x plus 1 is x times x to the x plus 1 integral 0 to infinity e to the minus x of w minus log w. And let's call this thing here w minus log w f of w. So now that we've put it in this form, we see that the integrand is only large where f of w is near its minimum. So our strategy is going to be to Taylor expand f of w near its minimum. And we see that its minimum is, since the derivative is just 1 minus 1 over w, this is 0 when w is 1. And so near its minimum, f of 1 is 1. So we just get 1 minus the second derivative is also 1. So we get half w minus 1 squared. These are the first two terms in its Taylor series. Okay. So if we plug this into our integral, what we get is e to the minus x. I can pull that out. E to the minus x. E to the minus 1 half w minus 1 squared plus dot, dot, dot. For now, let's ignore the dot, dot, dot. So this is approximately this. And the integrant, sorry, I'm missing an x here. An x. For large x, this should be x. Oh, x to the x plus 1. Thank you. For x large, the integrand is tiny away from w equals 1. So original integral was from infinity to 0, but the integrand is tiny from 0 to negative infinity for w less than 1. So it doesn't really change our result very much if we extend the limits of integration. This is because integrand is tiny. And this is an integral everyone knows how to do, just a Gaussian integral. So this is x to the x plus 1, e to the minus x, root pi, 2 pi over x. Okay. So this will give us the leading term in our asymptotic series. What if we wanted to keep more terms? So let's go back to this dot, dot, dot that we neglected. So, well, if x were very small, then it would still be true that the integrand would be smaller at from 0 to negative infinity than it than near 1, but not that much smaller. Like suppose x is 10 to the minus 10 or something. This decays very slowly, and we're probably changing the value of the integral.
What about when you extended f around its minimum value? Why do you need to do that?
So our basic technique is we know how to evaluate Gaussian integrals times polynomials. And if we massage an integral that's peaked in some region, so the integral, if we plotted the integrand, it has some peak. Some peak at w equals 1. It decays in some way away from there. And the approximation we're making is that our zeroth order approximation is we're going to approximate the integrand by a Gaussian. And then we're successively improving that by multiplying that Gaussian by higher and higher order polynomials. Okay. So these dot dot dot. How do we do better? So we kept more terms in the Taylor series. Taylor series up there. What we would get is that this plus dot 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 would be e to the minus a half w minus 1 squared plus some constant times w minus 1 cubed, and so on. We don't know how to evaluate these types of integrals. So we need to make a further approximation and write this as e to the minus 1 half w minus 1 squared times a series. So we want to write this as a series like this. So basically, we first Taylor expand f, we get a series in the exponential, then we Taylor expand any of the higher order terms and get a series multiplying the Gaussian term that we know how to deal with. And so we could go and compute the first two terms in the series. And if we kept the next non-zero term, we'd get the next term in the asymptotic expansion for gamma. Except not quite. It's not the asymptotic series for gamma. It's the asymptotic series for gamma over this extra function, x to the x plus 1, e to the minus x, and bring the 2 pi over here too. So we find what we get is an asymptotic series. The first term was just 1. If we kept the next term, we would get a 1 over 12x, and so on. And so what we get is an asymptotic series for what we wanted over some extraneous functions. Mary Jane. This term? This says C. Okay. Says some constant times W minus 1 cubed plus higher terms. And of course, asymptotic series are meaningless if we don't specify the limit point. And this is, of course, valid as x goes to infinity.
What happened to the 1 over square root of x? Is it still missing on the left
hand? Quite possibly, yeah. This should be half. Okay. So we've seen how this works in one example. I'd like to present the general method and include the case where instead of an integral over the real line, we have an integral over some contour in the complex plane. We'll run across these examples from time to time. So it's useful to develop the technology to find asymptotic series for functions that are given in terms of a contour integral. And the name of this method is either the saddle point method or the method of steepest descents. Okay. So let's suppose we want to evaluate some integral I of z that is given to us as a contour integral of some function times the exponential of z times another function. And we want to evaluate this for large real z. So in tutorial, we'll see ways we can come up with integral expressions like this for some expressions. There are lots of different techniques. Often, we're just given expressions like this that we want to apply the saddle point method to, like, for instance, in QFT. But it is much more general than that. So from the examples we've looked at before, we kind of know what we're going for. We want to approximate this integral by just looking at the place where the integrand is largest. So the dominant contributions probably come from a point W naught where I'll call it U, which is the real part of F of W, is a local max. But if this is a contour integral, we also have to worry about the phase. So if the phase is varying a lot, even if this real part is a local maximum, you could worry that the contribution with different phases will cancel out. So we also must have V, which I'll define to be the imaginary part of F of W, to be approximately constant along C near W naught. So let's try to phrase that a little more mathematically. So let's draw a picture first. So let's suppose our contour looks something like this. This is our contour C. This is the point W naught. And I'll denote the tangent vector to the curve as T hat. So if we want U to be a local maximum, then we should have the gradient of U should be perpendicular to T hat. We also should have that the gradient of V should be perpendicular to T hat if we want the phase to be stationary, we also know by the Cauchy-Riemann equations that the gradient of U and the gradient of V are perpendicular. Furthermore, we know that if C is a non-degenerate curve, then T is not zero. t hat is not 0. And if all three of these vectors are non-zero, then we've got three orthogonal vectors in a two-dimensional space. So that's a problem. So let's suppose that grad u is 0. That means by the at w naught, the Cauchy-Riemann equations then imply that grad v is 0. And vice versa. So the only way we can satisfy all three of these conditions at W naught are if W naught is a critical point. So that means that we must have F prime of W naught equals 0. So W naught is a critical point or inflection point. What about along the path near T, near W naught, but not at T naught? Near W naught, we still want the phase to be stationary. If the phase is oscillating wildly, it doesn't matter if the magnitude of the integrand is a local maximum. We won't get any meaningful contribution. So what we want to impose is condition 1 at W naught only, and 2, and we're forced to impose 3 along the path near W naught. And since, so this is where the method gets its name, since the real part of an analytic function has no local maximum, only saddle points. That's where the name the saddle point method comes from. So as long as we go through the critical point of F in the correct direction, we can basically apply the same logic we used before. We just basically want to expand F in a Taylor series. And then, because we know how to do Gaussian integrals, or integrals with Gaussian weight, more generally, we can approximate our original integral using a sum of Gaussian integrals. So at the Taylor series for F near W doesn't have a linear term, as W naught is a critical point. So it just has, in general, this form. And we can pull out a phase here. So let's rewrite this as e to the I delta naught times the absolute value of F double prime of W naught. Okay. The next thing we want to do is let's take our contour and linearize it. Near W naught. And let's let t with no hat denote a parameter that tells us where we are along this linear approximation. So write w equals w naught, and we'll let t be a real parameter. So the linear part of the path will take this form, where phi is telling us what angle we're going through the critical point. So we want f of w to be some constant minus 1/2 t squared f prime of w naught squared. So this would be what the first few terms should look like if we're going in the correct direction, so that we're approaching along a direction where the phase is constant and W naught is a local maximum. So let's compare our two expressions, and we can figure out what the phase has to be. So our first expression tells us W minus W naught squared times e to the I delta naught. Compare that to what we have here. This has to be equal to minus t squared. But W minus W naught squared is e to the 2i phi t squared. So e to the 2 phi I t squared e to the I delta naught has to be equal to minus t squared, which means that W minus W naught has to be equal to e to the minus I delta naught over 2 times e to the plus or minus I pi over 2 t. And this plus or minus will be determined by global considerations. Any questions so far? Just recapping our strategy. We started with this contour integral. We want to basically massage it into a real integral. And we're going to approximate the value of the original integral by just looking at where the integrand is largest. We want to make sure that we approach in the complex plane the place where the integrand is largest along a direction where the phase is constant. And then we're reducing this complex integral into a real integral of the type that we looked at before.
So why did we want, when you say that line, want to go to the rest? Why can't the quadratic term have a phase? The more you use it, it seems like the phase just doesn't have to depend on t.
The phase. So if we don't want there to be a phase here, because if there were a phase here, we would be approaching W naught along a direction where the real part is maximized, but the phase is changing as we change where we are along its path. So if there were a phase here, as we varied t, we would t is real, right? So if we had a phase, here, then yeah. So, or for instance, we could add a phase. We had a phase, the wrong phase, to just change the minus sign into a plus sign. Then W naught would be a place where the integrand is minimized. So that would be some place we could neglect completely. So this ensures this form ensures that the dominant contribution to the integral comes from a place near W naught. We're almost there. Okay, so let's plug our results so far back into the original integral. So our approximation now becomes I of z is approximately e to the z f of w naught. We've linearized the contour and thrown away the rest of the contour. So we're just integrating. So the contour is linear, approximately linear for minus t1 up to t1. And then we've got, so I haven't said anything about this function g out front of the integral. So if z is large enough, then g will change very slowly compared to the exponential part. So that's why we've been focusing on the exponential part so far. But now that we're going back to the integral, we can stick g back in. And we've massaged the exponential part of the integral into a Gaussian form like we want. We also need, we've done a change of variables. Originally, we were integrating over W. Now we are integrating over T. So we have this factor from the change of variables. And now this is in the form that we know how to deal with it. So we've got a Gaussian integral, something out front. And if we Taylor expand g, we can turn this into an integral of the type we've dealt with several times already this lecture. So we do that. What we get is e to the z half of w naught integral minus infinity to infinity. G W naught plus G double prime W naught over 2 factorial e to the 2 I phi t squared e to the minus c over 2 t squared f double prime of W naught e to the I phi dt. So we can now do the, this is a plus dot dot dot. We can now do the Gaussian integrals. So one other point. So I've extended the range of integration as before. So like before, if z is large, e to the minus z t squared times some other numbers will get tiny really quickly away from zero in this case. So we don't change the value of the integral very much if we change the limits. So we extended the limits. And now we can just do the Gaussian integrals. result is an asymptotic relation. I of z is approximately, or asymptotic to 2 pi over z, e to the z f of w naught over root minus f prime w naught g of w naught minus 1 over z g double prime w naught over 1 factorial 2 f double prime of w naught, and so on. And the angle drops out. Using the absolute value of f double prime w naught is e to the minus 2 I phi f double prime of w naught. So this is our final result. You may be wondering about the higher derivatives of f. We've just neglected those completely. When do they become important? That's actually a difficult question to answer and depends on the details of the integral. So the plus dot, dot, dot breaks down at some point. The next term in the series for g would just change the g double prime to g to the fourth, and this 1 factorial to 2 factorial, square this 2f, et cetera. So the series in g is easy. But how the derivatives of f, important the higher derivatives of f are compared to higher derivatives of g, is a detail-dependent question. But in practice, usually the first term or the first two terms are good enough. And it's rare that f triple prime matters in that case. Yes. Why isn't, so I used this relation. So we know the relation between the absolute value of f of w and f of w depends on phi. In the previous line, there were some factors of phi that I absorbed to get rid of all the absolute values. It turns out that this will be negative. Well, not always. So this is not necessarily a real expression on the right hand side.
But and like here, when you derive the relation between phi and delta zero, is that the requirement that like if your trajectory not only pass through the critical point, it also needs to go the direction that is required by delta zero.
That's right. So this was important in the derivation. We see it drops out in the final result. Often, you're given contours that don't pass their critical points. In that case, in order to use this method, you need to deform the contour so that it passes through the critical point at the correct angle. And in that case, it's important sometimes important to be aware of the angle so that you can tell whether or not you have to drag your contour across any poles in order to pass through the critical point at the correct angle. Or if you know where the poles are and what the residues are, you can deform past the pole and just explicitly include that extra term. Okay. questions on this? Okay, we have a couple minutes and go through an example quickly. So Hankel functions have an integral expression. It is this times a contour integration, integral of e to the I z cosine w e to the I nu w dw, where the contour c1 goes through the origin like this. This is minus pi, this is pi. So since this function is given to us as a contour integral, we don't have to do that much work to apply a result. How to derive contour integral expressions for functions like this is something we'll see one example of in tutorial today. There's many other methods that I unfortunately don't have time to discuss. But we can just compare this to our expression for I of z up here. And we see that g is just this e to the I nu w. F is I cosine w. And so this implies that the critical points if w is n pi for n an integer. So it already passes through one of our contours. So we don't need to deform this contour at all. It only passes through one of the contours. It's got a bunch of extra critical points that are completely irrelevant for our purposes. So all we need to do to apply our result is compute some derivatives. We get I won't go through those derivatives, but we just get a nice result for the asymptotic expansion as z goes to infinity of the Hankel functions. Really all we have to do is compute a few derivatives. I've skipped some of the intermediate steps, but it's really just computing more derivatives of G and F. So it's a really powerful technique. Okay, so this just about brings us to the end of our time together. So we've covered distributions, gamma functions, orthogonal polynomials, and now asymptotics in particular. Saddle point method. I hope you all see the deep connections between the subjects and that they're all mutually orthogonal, proving that the topics we discussed are in this course are at least four-dimensional. Really these topics were chosen so that you have the background necessary for future courses, and I hope you find what we've discussed in this course useful later in the year. Thanks for your attention.